We look back at the historic 2024 election and look ahead to how we can think critically about the administration to come. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, November 12th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, State Representative Tony Venhuizen joins us with a history lesson. We'll look at the gains Republicans have made in the State House. We'll also talk about a Trump economy and how that might impact the state budget. Then, what does it mean to live, work, and teach in a pluralistic democracy? A whole lot of Americans didn't vote for Donald Trump. We talk critical thinking and civil discourse as we strive to work together. Plus, Teacher Talk exhales and accepts the things we cannot control. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. There were seven ballot questions on the 2024 South Dakota ballot. Only one passed. Amendment F authorizes the state to impose a work requirement on individuals eligible for Medicaid benefits. Representative Tony Venhuizen from District 13 sponsored the legislation. He joined me for a conversation about what's next for the amendment. Venhuizen is author of the South Dakota Governor's Blog at sodacgovs.com. So we also talked about the historic importance of election 2024. I was looking on the South Dakota Governor's Blog, which people can find at sodacgovs.com, for some of the historic things to look for on election night, which I looked for, and then your recap, and there's some really interesting things that happened. Where do you want to begin? Maybe with margins and really how Republicans did in South Dakota this year in the presidential race and then moving into the state legislative races.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. Well, no surprise, it was a big Republican night across the country, and it was a big Republican night in South Dakota. I think your listeners know that. Looking at South Dakota particularly, very strong showing by Congressman Dusty Johnson. You know, the polling had shown him perhaps looking at a win in the mid-60s. In fact, he won 72% of the vote, one of the strongest showings as a percentage by a congressman in South Dakota history. Actually, his vote total, which is about 303,000 votes, is the most votes ever won by a statewide candidate who had an opponent from the other party.
Okay.
We've had a couple times where, you know, John Thune ran unopposed or Dusty only ran against a Libertarian. But when you have a Republican and a Democrat in the race, no one's ever won more votes than Dusty won this week. So that's certainly notable. The Trump ticket also had a good night in South Dakota. No surprise that he carried South Dakota, obviously, but he won about 63-64% of the vote, a little stronger than the other times he's run, and that's the third biggest win in South Dakota history for a presidential candidate. The best was Eisenhower in 1952, 72 years ago, Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, and now third is Donald Trump running this year. So ahead of Ronald Reagan, ahead of Nixon or Bush or any of the others.
The closest in history, 1896, you said on your blog. That goes back a ways.
It does. It would have only been South Dakota's second time voting for president, and it was one of the only times we didn't vote for the Republican. That year, William McKinley was the Republican nominee, governor of Ohio, seen as more of a representative of the Eastern business establishment, and his opponent was William Jennings Bryan from Omaha, Nebraska, a Democrat, but also a populist, and the Cross of Gold speech and sticking up for the farmers. And William Jennings Bryan carried South Dakota in 1896. And we elected a populist governor that year, too.
All right, let's look at who was populist governor that year?
Andrew Lee from Vermilion.
All right.
If you've gone to medical school, you went to the Lee Medical Building, thanks to Governor Lee.
All right, let's talk about the state house, the state legislators, and significantly Democrats are on a slow slide that continues. They have lost more seats, or conversely, you could say Republicans continue to gain support of South Dakotans in the state house.
That's right. You know, in South Dakota history, in 1952, the year that we voted for Ike for president, our legislature had two Democrats, 108 Republicans and two Democrats. So that's the all-time record, and we we probably will never break that. But it has now been a steady slide since 2008. 2008's the last time the Democrats gained seats in the legislature, 16 years now. And it's gotten to the point where you look at these elections and you can say, well, it can't get any worse. They've gotten to just their very core districts. And yet again this year, we gained one seat in the Republicans, one seat in the Senate and one seat in the House. The Senate seat that was gained is the seat that represents the Rosebud Reservation, in addition to some areas around that, mm-hmm. Which had generally been a pretty safe Democratic seat. So they'll have a 32-3 Senate, and in the House where I serve, it'll be 64-6.
Yeah, and Republicans are making gains in reservation area districts that include reservation territory that share geography with reservations.
That's right. All nine reservations in the coming legislature will be represented by at least one Republican. Not entirely Republicans, but at least one. And that has not been true for a long time.
Yeah, you mentioned these strongholds, District 10, District 15. Help people understand the difference between what might be considered, and I live in District 10, and it's kind of hard to think of it as a Democrat stronghold. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that means as a person in the neighborhood. Like, I don't walk around my neighborhood and think, ooh, I'm living in a Democrat stronghold. But I was redistricted. I used to be in 14, and now yes. I'm in 10. And so what's the difference between kind of like redrawing the lines to make those districts packed and then calling them strongholds? Like, how are we thinking about that? Because some of this is from the most recent redistricting.
Yeah, and it always used to be in Sioux Falls that there was one district in kind of the core center part of town. It was often called the Cathedral District because it's centered around this downtown cathedral area that was very Democratic. And then the rest of the districts, which kind of circle around or, you know, a ring all around the city, were pretty Republican. What happened in the last redistricting was really because of the growth of Sioux Falls and the growth, you know, a lot more people live downtown than used to, and this core part of the city has seen growth. Now there are really two central districts, District 10 and District 15. And then again, the ring around the city is more Republican. But in those two central districts, they elected all Democrats 2 years ago. You know, stronghold is maybe I use that word. Stronghold would imply that a Republican can never win there. That's not true. But there are clearly districts where Democrats are favored and should win. Now, actually, the Republicans did win one of the two House seats in District 10 in a bit of an upset. Bobby Andera beat Cameron Nelson, the incumbent. And then in District 15, both Democrats won, but Eric Mucky only beat the Republican by 9 votes. So they both have a lot of independent voters who seem to lean Democrat, but not always. And so they're competitive, but there are a lot of districts in the state where the Democrats just aren't going to win. And these are districts where they can and usually do.
Is there a historic reason for that? You mentioned the cathedral, and I think, was it like Democrat Catholics who lived around the cathedral?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so what's happening in my neighborhood in District 10? Hilltop.
You know, they're just older parts of town and more diverse maybe. And again, where you see the edges of town with the new construction and maybe more affluent, and they tend to be the more, you know, in the national parlance, you talk about the suburban voters. And those outer edges of Sioux Falls tend to be more suburban, and maybe these inner couple are a little more, I don't know if we think of ourselves as urban exactly, but a little more so.
All right. Let's talk about women. Going to peer 13 first-time female legislators. I'm going to make a most of the baker's dozen and get to know some of those women. But this is also state house-wide, we have more women going to represent their districts. Tell me a little bit about what you saw develop.
Yeah, that's right. And this has been a big shift in both parties. I would say Governor Noem has made an affirmative effort to recruit more women into politics and into running for office. So she probably deserves some of the credit for this as the first woman governor. But we actually set this record in the last election when we elected 31 women into the legislature. Yeah. This year that's 39, so a pretty big jump. I mean, that's almost a 25% increase in one term. Both houses will have all-time highs. 12 women in the Senate out of the 35, so just about a third. And then in the House, 27 women, so over a third. And as you mentioned, a number of them, 13 of them, are brand new first-time legislators. So
yeah,
we're seeing more and more women enter the process, and I think that's great.
You mentioned Governor Noem, and that brings me to Amendment E,
mm-hmm.
which was an effort. Senator Tobin, I remember, who did not win her primary, but who spoke openly about wanting to change the language in the state constitution to reflect that we have our first female governor. And Governor Noem at the time issued a statement when she signed the bill to send it to, you know, to the voters. This fails 57 to 43 because it kind of evolves into concerns about gender neutral or gender inclusive language that the voters consider more woke or they're tired of or what have you. How did we go from our governor saying, I want every little girl to know that she can grow up to be governor, or she can grow up to be Secretary of State, to voters saying, nuh-uh?
Well, of all the ballot measures, this was the only one that didn't have a dime spent one way or the other, really, unless you count the No on Everything campaign, which would have included this, I guess. The fact is, this amendment didn't change the meaning of the Constitution at all. No one's life will be different today than it was yesterday because this passed or didn't pass. What it did do was it went in, and if in places where it referred to the governor as he, it just changed it to say the governor. I voted for that because it's actually clearer language. You know, when you're using pronouns, you always have the risk that who is the pronoun referring to can be confusing. Mm-hmm. So saying the governor is better anyway. But you're exactly right. What this became was, we've had so much discussion in the country over the last couple of years about woke policies and, you know, they, them, preferred pronouns. And I think having no other information and no campaign, a voter goes into the voting booth and reads this description talking about gender pronouns and thinks, well, that's not anything. I'm not, you know, I don't want to support anything with gender pronouns. We don't need that in South Dakota. And probably misread the effect that this measure would have. But in the scheme of things, this isn't going to change anybody's life one way or the other.
Yeah. So we won't hear anything come back again, probably on this for some time.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. Unless there's some effort to make it clearer language to say what we're trying to do.
And it's just not a big enough deal. I don't know why anybody would expend the capital to take another run at this.
Anything else coming out of this next session that is prioritizing more abortion conversations? Or is it done?
I would be very surprised if our state is done talking about this issue. I do think Amendment G was defeated by a bigger margin than anybody anticipated. And so that may affect the decision-making going forward for advocates on either side. From the pro-life perspective, I think at this point there's just a real feeling of relief that Amendment G was defeated. I'm sure there'll be conversation going forward about what comes next, but I think perhaps the next move is really in the hands of the other side, of the abortion rights advocates, and if they're thinking of bringing something else and what they're going to bring. I mean, they were knocked back on their heels a little by that result, I have to think. I think we're the first state in the country to defeat.
Florida's fell.
Well, and so they were the same night.
And they counted sooner.
Right, they got their count sooner. There you go. But prior to Tuesday, the pro-life side had not won on any of these ballot measures, and we had a pretty big win.
So anything that needs to be added to make it more of a pro-life state than it already is?
Well, that'll be the question.
And then anything that needs to be done to address rape and incest survivors?
That is something that we'll have to talk about as a group of legislators. I do believe it has been true and it will be true that when we address the life issue, we want to do that as a team, as a group. That's the best way to get that done. And so I want to process the result and talk to some of my colleagues and understand where people are at and where they think the right direction is to move forward.
Because there was a time that that legislation wasn't passed simply because the intention was to get to the U.S. Supreme Court and overturn Roe. That no longer is part of the conversation because of the Dobbs decision.
Right.
But you still have rape and incest survivors who are in pain and are going to be asking for some kind of relief. And that's a big question for you to wrestle with.
Yes, it is. I'm sure that'll be an issue in the next couple years in the legislature. And I have to assume if there are future ballot measures on this topic, and I'd be shocked if there aren't, that issue will be more to the forefront.
Yeah. And then the video that the Department of Health put out, is that enough, a clarification? Because what I'm hearing from doctors is that it's not. And they still want more clarification about things that they can do to treat women whose lives are in danger.
What I have found is that it depends on what health providers you talk to. And there are some who don't like our current law and so don't want to see it work. And that will never change.
That is South Dakota Representative Tony Venhuizen of District 13. You can find the South Dakota Governor's blog online at sodacgovs.com. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Augustana University is hosting its second annual Critical Inquiry and Citizenship Colloquium. The event is going to feature a keynote presentation by Dr. Danielle Allen. She's a professor at Harvard University and director of the Allen Lab for Democracy Renovation at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation. That keynote begins at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, November 13th in the Ellman Center. That kicks off a two-day colloquium. And the whole thing is designed to promote civil discourse and deep reflection. The goal? To enhance students' skills to think critically and communicate persuasively as citizens of a pluralistic society. I sat down with Dr. David Golomboski. He's professor of government and international affairs at Augustana University.
The Critical Inquiry and Citizenship Colloquium is just a couple years old. It was established by a major gift to create an opportunity annually for Augustana to host a 1 to 2 day event to promote critical thinking, persuasive reasoning, civil dialogue and discourse on timely issues, and to highlight in that event a speaker of national prominence. And so in this way, it is similar to the Beau Forum, which brings someone well-known, high-profile to the state and to the campus. This colloquium is specifically focused on the topic of civil discourse. And so the speakers that we will see over the years may be political figures, may be involved in politics, but they may be active in other fields that bear somehow on how we live together as active citizens in a diverse democracy. Mm-hmm. So last year, the inaugural speaker for the colloquium was Dr. Michael Sandel of Harvard University, a political philosopher who came and spoke and engaged with students and faculty over the course of a couple days. This year's speaker is Dr. Danielle Allen, also of Harvard University. It turns out they have some smart folks up there, and so we're very excited to have her. She is also a professor of government. She is an expert on democracy and democratic theory spanning from ancient Greece to the present day.
Yeah, they turn out some smart folks as well. You have a history of education with Harvard as
it's
well.
It's true. I'm very fortunate to have attended there.
I'm gonna go off on a side note, and we'll circle back here. But the connection between a place like Augustana, a small Midwestern liberal arts school, and then an Ivy League institution like Harvard, which is well-established and well-known, there are some similarities, even though there are many, many differences. What have you seen as a professor at Augie that you say, we have some similar themes and values?
It's true. I mean, there are, of course, obvious differences in terms of national prestige, the missions of the universities. Harvard is a major research institution, and Augustana is a primarily teaching-focused institution. That said, as you point out, there are a lot of similarities in the mission we carry out in terms of pursuit of academic excellence, in terms of calling out of our students what they're capable of and their highest potential. And also, while Augustana is not primarily a research institution, we do carry on the tradition of teacher scholars, faculty who are engaged in the classroom and who are engaged in the production of knowledge, the cultivation of knowledge in their own research. And we do it in different ways than might happen at Harvard, but we're able to engage our students in the understanding that they're not only receiving information or learning facts, but also creative critical thinkers who are generating new understandings of the world around them.
This is one of the roles of the academy. One of the roles of a liberal arts education is critical thinking.
That's right.
Define it. What is critical thinking?
That's a great question. Critical thinking is the ability to take the world around you not merely as a given that you are obligated to accept on the terms in which it's handed to you, but as an object of inquiry and study, to take the world around you and to say not only what's going on, but why is it going on? What are the mechanisms that are driving the social realities we see, that are driving the material, physical, chemical realities we observe? And then how do I, as a person, engage with that world? What are the right principles for me to act on? What's the way to be a responsible person, a responsible citizen? And how do I take a look at the social practices around me and see where I can engage to make a difference, to make an improvement? I think critical thinking is not merely something that goes on in your brain, but that goes on in the full reality of being engaged and meshed in a world and figuring out how to respond.
Yeah, listening is a exactly. Active listening or compassionate listening, all part of critical thinking. All right, back to the colloquium. You really nailed the timing, right? So Dr. Danielle Allen, you and I are recording this before the results of the election have rolled in. This conversation will happen in the light of a whole lot of history that is going to unfold from the moment you and I are talking to the moment Dr. Allen arrives. And yet we know that she will have something to speak to because of her background in pluralism, in democracy. Tell me about her and the kind of message that you think she will bring to the keynote address.
Danielle Allen is a remarkable individual from my perspective for a couple of reasons. One is just the breadth of knowledge she has. She's one of these rare individuals who holds two PhDs. She has a PhD in classics and a PhD in government. And the way that plays out is that she is able to bring insights about democratic practice, democratic institutions across the history of democracy from ancient Greece to the present day, and then to bring those out in a way that has real practical meaning. So in addition to being a scholar and teacher, she runs a lab at Harvard that is dedicated to what she calls democracy renovation, thinking creatively about ways to improve democratic institutions and democratic practices. She also has been an active participant in democracy herself. She was a candidate for governor in the state of Massachusetts, the first Black woman to run for governor. It was not a successful candidacy, but it reflects her commitment, I think, to not merely thinking and writing about democracy, but to living it out in practical ways.
Yeah. So what else is happening other than the keynote in these, you know, several days? Is that in the university itself, is what's open to the public? Help us understand what will be happening.
So for the past couple of months leading up to the colloquium, we've been undertaking a series of initiatives or activities to engage people in the themes of civil inquiry, civil discourse, and active citizenship, including reading groups on Danielle Allen's work, engaging with some of the proposals she's put forward over the years for democracy renovation, as she calls it, and additionally relating her work to the themes of civility and civil discourse that the university has been undertaking more generally leading up to the election. Yeah. So this year, Augustana has engaged in a campaign that has been called Election 2024, Curiosity, Courage, and Civility. And this campaign has involved a whole suite of activities and opportunities for all parts of the Augustana community to come together during a divisive and difficult election season to model civil discourse and civil engagement across disagreement. Yeah. And those programs have been an effort to in some ways, demonstrate what's possible in a healthy political community.
All right. Has it worked? And here's what I mean by that question. You know, getting beyond we're afraid to say anything, because the sensitivity of that, and we might be shamed on social media, or it might be taken the wrong way, or it's just better to not talk about it. Beyond that, in the sense that, oh, we haven't noticed any problems, right? Have you noticed it working? That's what I mean by, is it working? Have you been able to see anecdotally a change in the way people are having conversations on campus, not just by the absence of some kind of conflict?
Of the three themes of the campaign leading up to the election on campus, where I would say I've seen some really exciting and remarkable results is in the area of courage. That Augustana is a community of really impressive scholars and students. Yet, because maybe of the Midwestern norms of humility and modesty.
There's some very nice Lutherans there.
That's exactly right. Our students are not always eager to go out on a limb to provoke disagreement or to be in what could feel like conflict with one another.
Yeah.
This season, we've seen a number of events at which students have come out of that shell to express disagreement in civil, constructive ways and to sort of sit with the discomfort of saying to someone else, I hear your perspective, but I see it a different way. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that in the scope of that conversation, you're not likely to come to agreement and full consensus, but that's an okay place to be. And I think we've had some issue forums where students have taken on really difficult issues, abortion, the Israel-Palestine conflict, immigration politics. And the goal of those conversations has not been to reach full agreement, but to reach some understanding and to be able to have the conversation, begin the conversation that might lead us down the road someday to a place of agreement. But at this point is bringing out that capacity to disagree in a productive way.
Bring the idea of evidence into this in the sense that if you think of the political opponent who you dislike the most in your mind right now, don't say it out loud to our listeners, unless you're alone in a room. But if you could understand why somebody would vote for that person if they believe a certain way, like if you believe the world is going to end tomorrow if this person becomes the leader of that free world, of course you would vote for the other person. But the evidence might not support that. So when you talk about the courage to have different opinions, how do you at Augustana then pull in what is the evidence that you have to support this opinion?
Dealing with the fragmented media landscape is one of the biggest challenges here, that people are just engaging with different sources. They're reading different materials. They're seeing different videos on their social media. And it can lead to a sense that we're living in different realities.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we have strived to do during this lead up to the election is, without downplaying the fact that there are real stakes in any election, and there are real stakes in this election, also give students a space to talk about the differences between the candidates, differences between the parties, in a way that is not catastrophizing. That's not focused on the absolute worst apocalypse that you can imagine occurring if the other side were to win, but rather is to say, okay, we have differing perspectives, and there are pros and cons. There are things that you gain and you lose by taking any particular stance or approach to a problem, and if the other side wins, sure, things will happen that I disagree with, that I don't like to see. But that's part of the process of democracy, is recognizing that sometimes your side wins, sometimes your side loses. And the goal after an election is to progress from that position of competition and looking to win, to defeat the other side, to a place of cooperation, coexistence, toleration, until we come back around to the next opportunity to make our cases.
Right. The work does not end at the when you fill out the bubble.
That's right.
I mean, the work continues then. It's not as, I mean, we get, one of the best ways to deal with sort of political anxiety is to go to the polls and to vote. You feel like you did something. But whether your candidate wins or loses, or your issue is, you know, put into the Constitution or not, you still have some kind of work to do in a civil democracy.
The title of Dr. Danielle Allen's keynote address on Wednesday is How to Be a Confident Pluralist. Mm-hmm. And that can be a little bit heady or abstract, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but what I think she means by it is how do we live as people who have to navigate a community, a society, in which disagreement is a fact of life? We live around people and work with people and in many cases, love, are married to, or are family with people who see the world differently than we do, who have different priorities or different values or different ways of realizing those priorities and values than we might have. And there are times when the appropriate thing to do is to make your case as forcefully as you can and persuade and out-organize and outmaneuver the other side. But moving on from an election, the time now is to figure out, how do we work together? How do we overcome or at least manage our differences in a way that we can still work together for the common good?
Even if you're side one.
Exactly.
Maybe especially if you're side one.
That's right.
Yeah. I also want to pull in religion and faith into this, partially because you teach at Augustana, but partially because you're something of a Thomas Merton scholar.
That's
Do
true.
I understand that correctly?
That's right.
This is a person who thought a lot about faith and the way it intersected with real life and with democracy and with justice. So you can't necessarily, for some people who are not believers, this isn't a challenge. But for some people who have deeply held religious beliefs that now they're grappling with in light of democracy and a ballot question that failed or succeeded that they disagree with, a candidate that they find outside their ability to stomach, what have you, how are we as people of faith to engage with all of this?
It's so complex, and that's why I have made religion and politics one of my main areas of study, because it's just endlessly fascinating and difficult. Religious values are often some of the most deeply held convictions that a person has. People, we see this around the world, are willing to fight, die, sacrifice themselves for their religious beliefs. People are willing to give up great deals in order to maintain fidelity with those traditions. And so it's no wonder that when they butt up against one another, that religion can be a source of conflict and even animosity in a democracy. At the same time, we see, first of all, that willingness of people of faith to generate conflict has often led to really important social progress. I think about someone like Martin Luther King Jr., for instance, who, motivated by faith and the deep commitments of his Christian faith, pushed society forward and generated conflict in doing it, but brought us to a more just place. More than that, or in addition to that.
Through nonviolence.
That's exactly right.
All right.
Well, that's right.
We'll add that in there. Keep going. Yes.
Additionally, many people of faith share common values, not only of justice, equality, freedom, but also share values of modesty, humility, cooperation, civility, kindness, and retrieving some of these in our political discourse would be a good thing. There's a time and a place to make your case forcefully, but to do so with the kind of love that a lot of people of faith can appreciate as a commandment, as an imperative of their faith. And so I have a lot of optimism that there's a way for people to bring their whole selves, their religious beliefs, their commitments, their practices to the political realm, to express those views and commitments honestly, and sometimes to provoke conflict by doing it, but to maintain the kind of respect and even love for our fellow citizen that can make that constructive and healthy.
Yeah. So what are we to do with righteous anger?
Righteous anger, to me, makes me think of our natural inclination to respond to injustice. Yeah. Then I think it's a human instinct to see things that don't sit right with us and to have a reaction. And that's a good thing. We would be worse off as a civilization, as a species, if we were naturally capable of being indifferent to injustice. Now, of course, lots of features of modern life make it easier to be indifferent at times when realities are far away from us, when we can feel insulated from injustice. But I think righteous anger is best understood as a natural response to seeing someone being mistreated or receiving something that you think they don't deserve. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to act on righteous anger. There are ways to express righteous anger that can be inflammatory, can exacerbate divisions and disagreements, but there are ways to channel righteous anger into not only political action, voting and organizing, not only discourse, talking and persuading, but also into charitable action, into the kinds of things that build solidarity and community among the people around you. So I think the challenge is, just like in any scenario where you feel anger, it may be justified. The challenge is to channel it into some way that, that builds up relationships and builds up community rather than breaks it down. And that's true in politics, just as in our households, in our workplaces.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about the Critical Inquiry and Citizenship Colloquium before we let you go? Because I think this has just been such a valuable conversation after people have had some time, you know, after the election day to sort of wait for results and process how they feel. It's a good reset point, I think, and then to get the next moment of inspiration or call to action in a civil society. Any final thoughts that you have as we move into the week ahead?
I think just as the election season has been exciting and has brought out a lot of energy, it also has produced some fatigue. By the time you get to the end of the season, and everybody says, you know, enough of the ads, enough of the arguing, enough, hand-wringing about what's going to happen. And so I do have hope that this colloquium will be a nice opportunity for, as you said, a reset, a kind of capstone to this season in a way that's forward-looking. That's a chance to say, okay, we're finished with the campaigning. We're finished with the uncertainty about who's going to be president next, who controls the House, the Senate. Now we move forward into what's it mean to be an active and engaged democratic citizen for the next 4 years or until the next election cycle. And I think through her keynote lecture, as well as meetings, discussions with university leaders, faculty, administrators, students, student leaders, Daniel Allen is also meeting with our Journey Scholars, which is a community of students on campus, students of color, who share time and space together to share their experiences. And Daniel Allen will be meeting with them as well. Mm-hmm. I think these are all going to be ways for us to put a bow on the election season, be glad that we're done with the parts of it we're glad to be done with, and move on in a way together as members of the Augustana community and members of the broader American community as well.
I love that.
Thank you very much.
That is David Golomboski, Professor of Government and International Affairs at Augustana University. You can attend the keynote 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 13th. It's at the Ellman Center in Augustana University. Tickets are free, but they are available at augie.edu. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Finding the balance between what you can and what you should control in your classroom can take time and a little practice. Learning to let go of things outside of our control and create an optimal learning environment is a skill. Let's dive into the balancing act of what we can and can't control with our Teacher Talk educators. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She is also an adjunct professor at Augustana University, the University of Sioux Falls, and the University of South Dakota. She is in her 25th year of teaching. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. Here's our conversation. What's the difference between control and classroom management? Like, same thing, slightly different nuances?
Right. I think it's more about setting parameters, setting expectations, maybe even like having some guardrails in place that keep things moving as they should. Because if you have this illusion that you can control it all, you're probably more likely to then lose control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, Jackie, when I think of classroom and control, I think of like, you know, a sitcom or a movie, you know, Kindergarten Cop, when like the kids are like climbing on Arnold Schwarzenegger because he's a substitute, and you've lost all control, it usually looks like young bodies flailing everywhere. What do you think of when you think of control?
One of my favorite scenes, speaking of talking about it as a sitcom, but in the pilot episode of Abbott Elementary, Jeanine Tiggs's class, she's the main star of the show. Her kids are kind of jumping around and dancing and singing, and then the veteran teacher, Barbara's in the hallway, and she says, "Your students are being really loud," and then she walks out, and Janine walks out to see Barbara's class is perfectly in a straight line, and they all simultaneously say, "Hello, Miss T." I really felt that as a teacher because I always was way more in the Janine Teague's classroom, right? Like, we're just living, learning loudly. And I don't know, every teacher does it their own way, but I would say the perception of control is that everyone is sitting quietly in a desk with a number two pencil that is sharpened, and we are raising our hands at the right time, that kind of
thing. So now we're past the perception.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fantasy of both out of control and in control. Uh-huh. Let's go to a little bit about what we're actually talking about. And Gina, you don't have control of your students' lives, and that's how you start this companion blog post out, which is like, I can't control that my student didn't sleep last night at all. I can't control that they, you know, slept in a car because they, you know, were evicted from their apartment. There's a lot about your students that you can't control.
There's a lot I can't control. Also, students come to us who have mental illness that's untreated. And students come to us, maybe their family wasn't evicted and they slept in a car. Maybe they got in a fight with mom and dad and then they slept in a car. I have the privilege of going to an elementary school every week with my teacher pathway students, and I sit by the office, and I see, you know, kids brought down there to take a nap because they were playing video games till 2-3 in the morning, and they came to school. Great, that's good. We'll let them have a nap, and then they can learn.
Yeah, if someone's in pain, if they're grieving.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah. 1 year, I had two students in the same classroom who both lost their dads to death.
Oh, jeez.
Really hard.
Yeah. And so, you know, and it's also losing a pet and losing a grandparent and somebody has cancer. There's so many things that really are a whole lot more important than the Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
On a lighthearted note, quick pivot to the lighthearted note.
Please bring us back from the edge. Yeah.
Simple things like when a new video came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, why is no one paying attention or knowing? And it was like, oh, the new such and such came out and we all stayed up playing it. Or when it came out, my kids were really jumpy. I remember the lawn was getting mowed and all my kids started screaming and they were like, it's it. And so, yeah, there's just, you know.
Snow.
Yes.
Boyfriends, girlfriends.
Yes.
Crushes.
Right. Oh, breakups. Yeah. Best friend breakups.
Oh, breakups.
Can't control any of that.
If you're in my class, don't date each other ever.
Right. But even best friendship breakups don't get talked about a lot. So those are really sad, too.
Friend groups coming and going.
Oh.
We could spend this whole time talking about the things that are out of our control when we're trying to teach commas.
Right.
High school was hard. Yeah. Middle school was hard, but high school was really hard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot, you know, a lot of pressure and a lot in American election and everybody responding, you know, to that. That's happening in the classroom.
Absolutely. The kids are talking about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. They want to know who's going to win, and then they do, and they want to talk about it, and you have to, Oof, that's a lot. And then you also say this thing about controlling your own beliefs about my students.
So
say more about that.
I'm just going to say, I think one of the things I am most proud of myself for, can we say that? I think we should say that more often. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of myself that every student I have, I do believe that they can grow and learn. I do have the ability to see how each of them is smart in their own way. And if I didn't have that, I would definitely not be in this profession very long because you have to have a belief that everybody can grow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That research that you put into your blog, I read today, and it's really good. It's really good research about teacher self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. Some of the self-efficacy work I had read when I was working on my dissertation, because some of that research was used to create the growth mindset survey so that we can measure what students' perceptions are about their ability to learn and grow. But I had not thought about the fact that the teacher's perception of their ability to help a student learn and grow, that is so impactful. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there was a lot of research.
That has been one of the sort of mind-expanding things for me as I've talked to you guys at Teacher Talk. And I'm starting to quote Teacher Talk all the time and say, I learned this in Teacher Talk, and I'm applying it at work. And one of that thing is, you know, I've accepted my own growth a little bit. Like, I really struggled with this technology, using some of the equipment that I get. That's just hard for me. Mm-hmm. But I'm growing. And I'm like, I got a little bit better this time. But believing that I could get better was important. Yeah. How teachers learning and feeling that they have control over their belief in their student and their ability to help that student make a connection or grow, that's got to be big.
It's huge. And a lot of times when I talk with teachers who are thinking about leaving the profession, it's because they don't feel like they make a difference anymore. Yeah.
That makes me sad to think about, but I know that feeling of, I think we all go through periods of time like that where we wonder if what we're doing matters. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, there was just something about reading that reminded myself, like, what are we doing here if we don't believe that what we're doing matters?
Oh, my goodness. School does not work without hope.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no hope, you can't do school.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Tell me about Free Fridays.
That's where the whole
Freedom
idea.
Fridays.
Yeah.
Free Friday.
Yeah. So my art teacher friend Aaron and I decided we were going to do Free Fridays last year together and support each other in that structure. And so with my English classes and her art classes, on Fridays, students could choose what they wanted to do that had to do with this discipline, this class that they're in, but they could follow their own curiosity.
Mm.
They could work on what they already love within English language arts, within the visual arts. And they're all arts, so that was really special, and it was easy to connect that. And what was hard, let me say, too, that this is not some sort of radical idea. English teachers have always, for years, provided sustained amounts of time to just read for fun or write for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something called genius hour. So science teachers, sometimes social studies teachers, provide maybe an hour a week or so for students just to explore what they're curious about in science or social studies. And it's a reminder of the fact that learning is fun. Mm-hmm. Learning is joyful and fun. It can also be challenging, right? And usually students choose something that's in that sweet spot of it's challenging but also joyful. I think too often we think that challenging things have to be miserable and joyful things have to be easy.
Mm.
But really, the sweet spot is when it's challenging and joyful. So
I like that.
So anyhow, on Fridays, my students could read whatever they wanted to read. They could write what they wanted to write. I had some students writing lyrics, which was awesome.
Love that.
I loved it so much. Most of them chose to read, though.
Yeah.
And I think
it's going to make you feel good.
Either way, I felt good.
Yeah.
Some of them, they were reluctant, right? Mm. And some were easily distracted. And so I had to constantly be vigilant about just giving them a smile, giving them a look.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe sitting a little closer toward where they're sitting to help them not be tempted to be distracted or mm-hmm. do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to just be immersed in it myself because I like to sit with the students and do what they're doing. And so I think my frustration and sense of lack of control came from the fact that I was constantly having to switch from, okay, I'm reading and modeling, now I'm watching, now I'm watching, now I'm reading and modeling, now I'm watching, now I'm watching, now I'm giving a look, mm-hmm. now I'm giving a little knowing smile. And I had to just finally trust the fact that the kids would get what they needed out of it, and I just had to trust that process.
That's Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. There is more to our conversation. Listen to the full Teacher Talk online at SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. You can find it at sdpb.org or any podcasting platform. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.